Welcome to Vermont Favorites on WBTV LP Burlington 99.3 FM. I'm Adam Rabin. Each week I talk with musicians, artists, performers, and creators about their unique journeys and what they love about living in Vermont. My guest today is an accomplished jazz guitarist who has been compared to George Benson and Pat Martino. Not one to simply coast on his jazz street cred, he has picked up bass guitar and joined a progressive rock band, which just happens to be my progressive rock band. But true to his Vermont roots, he is equally skilled at raising goats and making cheese and soap. Please welcome my bandmate and Vermont favorite, Bob Gagnon. How's it going, Bob?
Hello, Adam. Thanks for having me in.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah, so this is a little unusual for my compared to my other episodes where I'm having someone who's actually in my band on my show. So I hope you don't mind being the guinea pig.
No, I'm happy to be a guinea pig. Tell me about... Here's me interviewing you.
Yeah, go for it.
The theme music.
Yeah.
Did you write that?
I did.
Perform it?
Yeah.
It's great.
Thank you. Thank you.
It's groovy.
I knew when I was putting the show together, it's like, I got to have something upbeat and a little funky. So I threw that together. So now everyone in Radio Land knows that that's me. Mm-hmm. So you are, but now to turn the tables back to, you know, because it's my show.
Right.
You're a Vermont native, one of few. I've had about half of my guests have been natives. The other half have been flatlanders.
Yeah, there was a program on the radio today on another station that I didn't hear, but they were talking about what makes a Vermonter. And, I wondered, I'm third generation. My great-grandparents from both sides came down from different places in Quebec. And... my father's people, they were farm workers. They weren't farmers. They didn't have their own farm. But when they came, some of them stopped in St. Albans, and that's the group that spawned me. And some of them continued down to Connecticut to work in the tobacco fields. And around the same time, my mother's grandmother came down to Burlington and opened a boarding house. And so my mother grew up in Burlington. And, but, you know, I guess I'm third generation, so that must make me a Vermonter, and maybe it makes my parents
quite
Vermonters. But it wasn't long ago that, you know, they weren't.
Yeah. So you live in the islands now.
Mm-hmm.
What got you from Burlington? Were you born in Burlington?
Born in Burlington, and the first street I lived on was Front Street. So I'm an old North Ender. And then when I was about three, we moved further north, up by the river, and the Winooski River. Mm-hmm. And so that was our backyard. My dad got a job at IBM, so we moved to Jericho and then Essex Center to, you know, get closer to IBM.
Right.
So I went to school in Jericho, elementary school in Jericho, and then high school in Essex. But I consider myself from Burlington, whereas my older brother and sister, just 1 and 2 years older, they say on their Facebook profiles that they're from Jericho. But, you know, it's when I'm – and I loved Jericho, and I still do.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I'm hanging around the North End, that's – you know, that kind of feels like home.
That's where you feel like you're from.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you come to the old North End, more old North End?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Because I'm trying to think when the new North End really became the neighborhood that it is was probably still happening when you were growing up. It wasn't quite there.
Yeah. When we moved, you know, off Front Street and we moved, there's a little road past the water treatment plant.
Mm-hmm.
And don't know if this is too specific for worldwide radio, but past the water treatment plant on North Avenue, there's a little road that goes down to the river. There are about four houses down there.
The very end of North Avenue.
It's not the very end.
Yeah. But you go past the water treatment and then there's...
It's sort of right across from Northgate Apartments.
What you mean.
There's a little road. And the house we lived in, I went to visit it last summer, and the house we lived in is gone. It was actually... a camp.
Yeah.
You know, that...
Well, it's funny because that part of... Because I live probably about a 10-minute jog. Like when I jog, I go from my house, and you know where that is, mm-hmm. and then I go up, try to get to the Colchester line on the bike trail bridge, right? So that one little part of Burlington is like the only part of Burlington that feels at all rural.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It's yeah. it's because it's kind of like a dirt road, and it's really the end of civilization as
it
we know it.
Really is. It and feels now, like it when you're down there too.
Yeah, and now you live within like a 2-minute drive of the Canadian border. So now you're like really way out,
yeah.
way out there. So what brought you out of the big city of Burlington, Vermont, up to the northern, you know, the Hero?
When I got back from Ithaca College in 1987, of course I moved into my parents' house for a little bit. Mm-hmm. They were living in Hinesburg at the time. And then I got an apartment in the old North End. on North yeah. Winooski Avenue.
Yeah.
And then I got another apartment in the old North End, also on North Winooski Avenue, while I was going to grad school at St. Mike's. And then I got a job near Montpelier, so I moved to Montpelier.
Gotcha.
And I was in Montpelier most of the time from 1989 to 1999.
Yeah.
There was a spell there where I spent a ski season in Aspen playing gigs in ski bars.
We'll have to talk about that.
Yeah. And yeah, then I came back and got a job at the same place.
Mm-hmm.
And so I lived in Montpelier, and then I got married in 1997.
Okay.
And we got a house in Montpelier. And
oh, so you actually lived out there for a while.
Yeah, and till 99. And then my wife got a job in Colchester. She had been working in Rochester, New Hampshire. So she'd been commuting.
Yeah.
Yes, commuting from Montpelier to Rochester, New Hampshire.
Yeah.
So when she got a job in Colchester, we had one summer rented a cabin in North Hero.
Yeah.
And when I was a kid, my dad would take us up to the islands to fish, you know.
Yeah.
Grand Isle, South Hero, usually not North Hero, but we were vacationing in North Hero, and we saw a house built around 1830, and
oh, wow.
we liked it, and it was yeah. for sale.
So it kind of the house, the location, kind of brought you back to those memories of fishing back in the day.
Yeah, and my wife doesn't fish, so it was sort of crazy to move up there, and we're way up there.
You really are,
and it's. The realtor told us that if you took our house and put it south of the drawbridge on Grand Isle,
mm-hmm.
add $50,000.
Right.
So we were happy that at that point that it was 8 miles north of the drawbridge. And there's some, you know, some land,
yeah.
six acres, and then we're surrounded by about 100 acres of corn and hayfield.
Yeah. It's really pretty up there.
Which is sometimes 100 acres of manure spread on a hot August muggy day.
Yeah. Well, that's Vermont. You're a Vermonter.
Yeah.
So that's just this, you know, that's just the smell of spring.
Although I have to say I'm a Chittenden County Vermonter.
Okay.
So there were a lot of things that I mean,
took a little getting used to.
Yeah, there were a lot of things I didn't experience as a Vermonter that you know, I was as much of a city boy as you can be in
right.
Vermont. And you know, between, you know, downtown Burlington and Essex Center, I didn't smell a lot of.
No, you probably air. Didn't.
And yeah. another thing I didn't experience until I met people who lived outside of Chittenden County was mud season, which I can tell you about. But when we moved to the islands and we had the land, and my wife said, well, I don't fish, so.
Why are we moving up
why
here?
Why are we up here?
Yeah.
And then, so then she said, well, if we're going to have this land, let's put animals on it. That's how we started with
the goats,
raising goats and stuff like that. Yeah, I milk the goats. She makes the cheese. She does the value-added products. But
nice.
Which we cannot sell. We can sell the milk. We can sell
okay.
50 quarts of raw milk a day.
Right.
But because we make the cheese and yogurt, we can sell the soap unless you're going to eat it. Unless, because we make the
cheese. You can't regulate against stupid.
Right. But because we make it in our kitchen, it's not like a you need a commercial kitchen. Right. You can't just do it in your kitchen.
So getting back to your childhood, because that's what we do here. Mm-hmm. We inspect your brain and figure out how you got from there to here. You started playing guitar when you were six.
Yes. Yeah. Got a guitar for Christmas when I was six. I turned seven 12 days later. So
yeah. We'll call it seven. What kind of guitar was it?
It was a Silvertone. It was a Sears guitar. Sears Roebuck. You could buy guitars from Sears back then. Mm-hmm. And actually, I have a 1965 Sears amp. Well, my dad has it now. We've traded back and forth. It was the amp that I grew up playing.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's a tube. It's a tube amplifier, two 12-inch speakers, little piggyback amp. And if you watch the movie That Thing You Do,
yeah,
you'll see this amp. Before they got successful and got Fender amps in the movie.
Right, I'm following.
The guitar player had a Silvertone guitar and the same Silvertone amp. But I will tell you, I got hired to do a recording session as a sideman for a songwriter from upstate New York, and he had hired out Levon Helms' studio and Levon Helms' engineer. So this wasn't a Levon Helm record or anything. I saw Levon walking around outside.
Yeah.
I walked in with my guitar, and the engineer looked at me and said, "Guitar, over here." And he plugged me into the same mid-60s Sears Silvertone, which was made by Dan Electro, actually. It was
nice.
Sears didn't make anything.
So he was going for that was it retro at the time, or was it? It was still old school.
It was, you know, it's a warmer sounding than a Fender, and it gets dirty sooner than a Fender does, which is a lot of people's complaints about Fender.
They stay too clean.
They stay, which is the way I like it.
Yeah, I mean that's my taste in Fenders. I keep going. You know, I've been through a few electric guitars, and I'm always thinking back to one of the first ones that I had was a Strat, and I kind of regret getting rid of it. It wasn't a quality Strat, so kind of like, you know, after like 15 years or so, it just didn't sound like it used to. Mm. But yeah, there is something to that.
My dad plays guitar,
mm-hmm.
and he is a student of rockabilly and Chet Atkins, and you know, and he can play like Chet Atkins, although his technique, he had to alter his technique because he's left-handed.
Oh.
So he has...
Did your dad play a left-handed guitar?
Yeah, he does.
Okay.
And he learned initially on a right-handed guitar that he was holding upside down.
Right.
And then his uncle said, "Hey, you can just switch the strings."
Yeah.
And then around 58 or 59, he got a Gretsch Duojet lefty. And at the time, Gibson wanted 6 months and a lot of extra money to deliver a lefty Les Paul, and Gretsch wanted 30 days.
Hmm.
And so he went Gretsch. And I think I like the sound.
Of Gretsch over Gibson?
Over Gibson. I've had four Gibsons, and, you know, I've let them all go. And now I have a Gretsch. Yeah.
And your dad still plays, right?
He still plays. And... So he was my first teacher. He insisted that I learn how to read initially. You know, age six, here's a book, you're going to learn how to read. Mm. And which is weird because guitar players don't know how to read. And that separated me, that kind of isolated me when I got into high school.
But I mean, it is learning how to read music, it will set you up and above everyone else. Mm. And it makes communicating a lot easier and a lot more efficient.
I'm happy it worked out this way. While he was teaching me to read with a book, he was teaching me other things by rote. He would, "This is how you play Wildwood Flower," was one of the first songs he taught me how to play. He needed somebody to accompany him because he played guitar and banjo, dobro, mandolin, fiddle. He needed an accompanist. So, you know, they had six kids, but he only got one
guitarist. So he finally gave birth to his sideman that he needed.
And, you know, and lessons with him were informal. It wasn't like...
He wasn't trying to, like, live vicariously through you and...
No, he
wasn't that showbiz parent.
No, and he didn't really. He made it available to all of us kids. Hmm. Like, here are guitars. Here's the book. Go ahead. You want to learn that page? Learn that page and tell me when you're done. I didn't have every Wednesday at 3 o'clock a lesson, and nobody was paying for it, so nobody was uptight about it.
Right.
Like when I was, my mother-in-law was paying for my son's piano lessons.
Yeah.
So I was uptight. Like, she's got to get her money's worth. Go practice.
But. Right. So what was the motivation for you and your dad then? What got you to keep doing it, knowing that you didn't have the pressure, or your dad didn't have the pressure of, you know, the set time and the money?
Mm-hmm. Well, there were a couple of things. So he showed me some things, and I think what I liked was the attention that I got. By the time I was 7 years old, there were six kids in the family.
Mm.
And I was the third. Oh, I still am.
Yeah.
You can't shake that. If my dad was showing me this and he wasn't showing anybody else, not because he wouldn't, but because they were jocks or
you're the one that showed
whatever.
Interest.
And,
yeah.
So I think it was motivating that I was getting some attention that nobody else was getting.
Hmm.
And then there's the way, and I'm seeing this, I saw this with students I was teaching when I was teaching private lessons at Harwood High School, and I see it with one of my sons. If somebody's wired to play music, they're just wired to play music.
Hmm.
I could never do sports, you know?
Right.
But I've got a brother and sister who were ridiculous jocks making varsity when they're, you know, freshmen or whatever. And I couldn't do anything like that. I didn't.
And you took that to college. You took that skill to Ithaca?
That's right. That's right. And so there was something, there's something that I can't describe about the motivation.
Okay.
Because I just had to do it. And I don't think I was aware too much at the time. Although, when I was about 10 years old, my uncle, who had been living in England, came back to the States, and he moved in with us for a while. And my dad was giving him guitar lessons. And then I got mad because that attention that I was supposed to be getting was going to my Uncle Dave.
His brother?
His brother.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I picked it up with greater fervor at age 10.
Oh, interesting. So that kind of drove you, that competition almost.
Yes. And in fact, I was raised, we were a church-going family.
Right.
There were a lot of things about that that just didn't take with me. They didn't stick. But at age 10, I started playing in church with my dad. And then we moved and when I was 12, we moved from Jericho to Essex Center, and we started playing in a different church. And there was a rehearsal every Monday night, and then a gig every Sunday. And then sometimes at Christmas, there'd be three gigs, because we'd play the children's mass on Christmas Eve, and then maybe midnight mass. And then if the next day happened to be a Sunday, then you had to go to church three times in 2 days. But
right.
It would be three gigs for me. And that was motivating as well. I liked the people very much, you know, in the folk group. It was Catholic, so we were strum and hum music, they called it.
I get it. It's got to be a great, encouraging environment to be learning, especially at like age 10, where it's, you know, we're all very ill at ease in our own skin, and we're still figuring out who we are. So to be playing guitar and getting that encouragement, you know, never mind the religious aspect or the church part of it, but you got a community of people who are saying, hey, this guy can play, this kid can play.
Right, and they're appreciative of it. And there were parts of that that gave my dad some opportunities for teaching. For example, look, you've got three guitar players all playing the same thing.
Hmm.
Notice what other people are playing and don't do something different. If they're voicing the chord here, you learn the chords over here. And that was part of my training, that it really applies to being, you know, being a jazz musician, or just being aware of all the music that's going on around you, and don't compete with it. Find out where you
compliment.
Fit.
Yeah, compliment. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes, yeah. absolutely. Especially in like you say, in the jazz and in the folk. More so in the jazz. I can see in the folk, you got like people strumming the same chords. Strumming and humming, as you say.
Yeah.
The same chords.
They'll strum the ones they know.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And then in punk, you know, you got everyone driving on the same track. You know, but yeah, to branch out. That's a great piece of advice to get early on. Yeah. Listen to what everyone else is doing.
And I get this early on, which was another, I see it now as part of my training, but at the time, of course, I didn't. But we used to play with my grandfather. My dad's father played harmonica and liked old country music. So yeah. It would be, oh, whatever, you know, George Jones songs or Porter Wagoner songs, you know, 60s country, the kind that actually I like.
Yeah.
And he would play them on the harmonica, but you know, sweet man, but he couldn't count, you know, that, you know, and I love him, but he couldn't count. And I remember looking at my dad going, what, he only gave three beats in that. And I'm trying to play the song right, whatever. I'm 8, yeah. 9, 10, 12 years old. And I'm trying to play the song correctly. And grandpa skips a couple of beats and goes on to the, and I remember my dad looking at me sternly.
Yeah.
And saying, listen to him.
And that's good advice also. I'm trying to think, like a few bands, like the band that we were in, the 80s cover band, for example. Every once in a while, like, we would lose our place, you know, because you're playing for 3 hours. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it happens. And the rule that the band always had was the singer is always right.
Mm.
Like, if everyone loses their spot, if whatever the singer's doing, that's where you got to go.
Make the singer right.
Yeah.
Yep. And that translates to jazz. It's a great Herbie Hancock quote where he says something like,
yeah,
Miles plays a lot of wrong notes. It's my job to make them right.
Oh, wow. That's a great line. Yeah. So, okay, I've kind of pushed you toward the Ithaca College thing because I want to find out more about like the higher education and then like your first steps out with your the Bob Gagnon Trio / Quartet in the late 80s. How did that come about? What was that experience like?
Well, Ithaca was, you know, I didn't go in knowing very much about jazz. I didn't grow up with jazz. What happened in high school was I couldn't play with other people, with other guitar players and bands, because nobody had music.
Right.
And there is, you know, there are two skills that were being developed, you know, by different people. And one was reading, and where if you rely on reading, your ear training may go a little slower, which it did with me.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were people who were playing by ear.
Yeah.
So in high school, my friend John, who now I'm in a band with now,
right.
he was playing by ear. And I was reading, and so when we got together, there wasn't anything, because he would learn YYZ by ear,
yeah.
And I'm like, where are the dots? And so I couldn't play with anybody, so I was working a lot on my own, and I got into James Taylor and Paul Simon, and I began to dig the more sophisticated harmonies that they were using. You know, I was beginning to leave, you know, As a young player, I think you like the music that you can do, or at least imagine yourself doing, playing.
Yeah.
Like, I can handle this.
We like what we're good at.
Right. I can play, you know, so at age 13, I could play Heart of Gold, so I liked to play Heart of Gold.
Yeah.
But then I got interested in other sounds, and James Taylor was making those sounds, and Joni Mitchell, and
yes.
Paul Simon.
Yeah.
So I'm hearing more sophisticated harmonies. I'm learning about these harmonies, but I didn't know about improvisation. Yeah. I didn't have a jazz repertoire. But I saw pictures of Ithaca. I knew they had a music program. I knew it was near a lake. It kind of looked like Burlington to me. There was a college at the top of the hill, downtown on a lake. You know, everything
that's, does sound familiar. Yeah.
Everything was familiar enough to me that I didn't even think about Berkeley or a school in New Orleans, for example.
Right.
So Ithaca was the only school I applied to. And when I auditioned...
So much for safety schools.
Yeah. What they do now, you know, my son is looking at music schools, and they're very clear on their website, we want you to play a blues a Charlie Parker tune. We want you to, you know, show that you studied the different styles of jazz. And here's a list of songs you can choose from. And that made it very easy. I went to the audition not knowing what they were going to ask for.
Oh.
And I happened to know a couple of jazzy Chet Atkins things. I could play Sandman, you know, and I could sight read. So at the audition, when they put music in front of me and said, sight read this, I was able to pass the audition. But when to show my picking and fingering technique, I played some bluegrass tunes that my dad had shown me. And I heard somebody else quote the head of the jazz department at the time, as I was going in as a freshman, talking about my playing. The professor said, he's good at what he does. I don't like what he does.
And this was the school you were about to enroll in.
Right. But it was a small program. And, you know, many of the standard, the tunes that are jazz standards, my dad already was playing. You know, he would already play All of Me and Ain't Misbehaving, like some of these tunes from shows or that were just in the American Songbook that jazz players like to play. I did know them, not in an improvisational context or anything like that. And one of the first courses that was required was a jazz history course. Yeah. So we started from the beginning of recorded jazz, and we had to go to the library and check out the Smithsonian Institute collection of classic jazz and put the vinyl on the turntable with your headphones and
very cool.
Do our listening assignment.
Yeah.
And that's when I heard bebop and I heard Charlie Parker and Dizzy. And that is what hooked me.
So you kind of had to, you discovered it not on your own, but as part of the subsequent courses.
Right.
And now you're saying that your son is looking at schools and it's like a requirement just to enter to be familiar with all this stuff.
Right. And he's got an advantage because he's a horn player.
Okay.
And guitar players, you know, horn players are just exposed to more sophisticated music in general than guitar players are. There are more, if we didn't even have a jazz band when I was in high school. But if there had been a jazz band, there would have been one guitar player.
As many
sax players as would want to join, right?
Like one guitarist.
Yeah. So the opportunities to be exposed to that music, to even know that it's out there. You know, I was listening to, you know, Shom on the radio. I was listening to rock music. That exposed me to an interesting segment of rock music. I heard my first Peter Gabriel on the Montreal radio station. So just by nature of what horn players get to play in the school jazz band and in the school orchestra, they learn more about music overall than a guitar player, especially now a guitar player getting tabs off the internet and, you know.
Yeah.
You don't even have to think. There's a movie right there of somebody showing you how to play Eruption or whatever. Whatever it is.
Eruption didn't exist when we were going to school, right? I am talking with Bob Gagnon. You're listening to Vermont Favorites, a production of 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington. And we're talking about jazz guitar and listening to Montreal radio up by the border. Now, tell me, what other kind of stuff were you listening to? Because when you and I first met and we were talking about you playing bass, which I want to get into, you told me about your three big influences as a bass player. And I was wondering which of those and how you... Well, tell me who they were first, because I remember two of them. I don't remember all three of them.
I don't remember all three of them either. Well, certainly Jaco Pastorius.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Lesh.
Right.
And Ray Shulman from Gentle Giant.
Right. So that's a very broad spectrum. So you got your jazzer, you got your Grateful Dead, you know, so you got your folk blues rock, and then you got Ray Shulman from progressive rock band, you know, English progressive rock band. Three vastly different styles.
Different, but not one of them played bass like a bass. Like, nobody did Jaco before Jaco. Phil Lesh was not a bass player. When he was a trumpet, he was at UC Berkeley studying classical trumpet, I think, or modern. There's some deadhead out there who can clear this up. He was studying, I think, electronic music and modern composition, like 20th century composition, and he was a trumpet player. What's similar about these people is that they brought a melodic sense to the bass that wasn't like there before. When I listened to, Gentle Giant record, and I hear what Ray Shulman is doing, and I suspect a good deal of that was arranged.
Yeah, well, Kerry Minear, the keyboard player, he did the lion's share of the arrangement, but I know the Shulman brothers, they grew up in a house just filled with musical instruments of all kinds. You know, and their dad was a big band player. I forget what he played, but, you know, so there was that deeply ingrained musical education. So they learned every instrument and every philosophy, you know, to every approach. This brings us to your time playing bass. What made you decide to pick up a bass after doing all, you know, playing for so many years as a guitarist?
I was in a band, and it was sort of a wedding band, and I got tired of it. And I guess it had been in the maybe 8 years running or something like that. And I was in the mood. I was itching. You know, I'll get to a point every few years where I get completely tired of hearing myself. And, you know, I think of the best guitar player I could think of. So let's say Pat Martino. Mm-hmm. If you listen to Pat Martino every night, you'll soon get tired of Pat Martino. So how can I possibly listen to me every night, right, without getting tired of it? And so I went for a spell. I tried mandolin. And so when I was on that recording session at Levon Helm's studio, actually also called myself a mandolin player, and I knew the tune that I was going to have to play on, and I composed a solo to make it sound like I was improvising, and everybody thought I could play mandolin. And then I looked at the mandolin and I said, well, I'm not going to make any money with this instrument. You know, I didn't want to put too much time into something that I could, you know.
There's a limited number of outlets for mandolinists.
And then I was leaving the wedding band, and I wanted some work. And I know as somebody trying to put together jazz trios and quartets, sometimes I have to call six bass players before I can find one available. Good bass players are working all the time.
True.
So I said, maybe I can be one of those.
Getting in on the supply side of the supply and demand.
And some friends, bass player friends of mine said, great, I'll send work your way when I can't take it. And that was happening. Nice. And so I think I jumped in to some situations before I was ready. But, you know, why not, right?
Sometimes you got to go a little bit, you know, you got to play a little bit above your level to kind of get to that level.
And a little there, I was playing, I did some blues gigs on bass. Yeah. And I have never studied the blues. I have played some blues. You know, but a jazz blues written by Charlie Parker is not the blues.
Right.
It ain't Muddy Waters. So there's a different role of the bass in, you know, traditional blues playing. And I did a few gigs and I don't have that. I don't have that stuff.
Yeah.
And so
kind of forcing yourself to broaden your horizon, you know, not that you, you know, because we all have day jobs. We all do something for, you know, our actual bread and butter, you know, and food on the table. But yeah, if you're going to do something like music for fun, yeah, it's great to make a few bucks and hopefully make enough to cover your hobby, right? The expenses of the hobby. But if you're going to do it for all these years, you know, why not take some risks and stretch out a bit?
Yeah. And that, I'm happy for the blues gigs that I did. I know that if I expect those people to hire me back, then I've got to go back to records that were made 50 years ago and learn how to do it right.
I understand what you mean.
I don't know if listeners can see the air quotes, but I mean right. And excuse me, and I don't want to do that.
I don't want to do that.
Yeah. And this is the thing that, I mean, I realize anything a musician learns that's not already in front, you know, in on their fingers or in their ears, everything expands you as an artist. I dig that. But how much time do I want to spend with each thing? I spent a couple of years really studying Django Reinhardt to do that stuff on guitar. And then I began to notice that to a large degree, there's a contest to see who can out-Django the other guy.
Right.
And it takes, there's some, I don't know who said this, but somebody said, the first 30 years of trying to play like Django are the hardest. Right? Like that's, if right. you want to do it, that's how long it's going to take. And I was playing.
And that's not really a business plan.
No.
30 years.
So I was playing in a little Django group
yeah.
with another guitarist. And this guitarist said, oh, I just hate it when I hear like Jerry Garcia influences in people's playing. Like there's some purity whereby you must, you're evaluated on the basis of how well you sound like a guy who died 50 years ago. And it's the same in jazz. And it always has been, although I went into jazz, and I love jazz, and I'm not knocking it. But there is, it's not as free and as accepting of new sounds and influences as you would think, as I thought. And
as we would hope.
Right. And you know that when somebody really new and original comes along, they can't get work. Ornette Coleman was fired from bands. Mm-hmm. People who were beboppers were fired from bands. You know,
I see a lot of that. Like what you said, you know, getting evaluated based on how much you sound like so-and-so from a generation or two ago. And I see that a lot in, like, say, our sub-genre of progressive rock. I see some people truly innovating, and I see other people who are just toeing the line, and they'll say, you know, I can fit into this line of work, you know. And these guys are great because, you know, they really wear that flag of 1973 on their sleeves, and they do it really well. And then there's some people, and I mean, there's been countless discussions about whether the P in progressive rock should be capitalized or lowercase, right? Mm. Do you sound like the progressive rock, or are you actually progressing the form of rock?
Mm-hmm.
So there is some of that in rock as well, and I would imagine in other types of rock music. How do you see jazz and rock? Do you see that same parallel, or do you think one is more free than the other?
What I'm finding, and I'm late coming to rock music.
Mm.
You know, I was all James Taylor and Joni Mitchell, and then I went to jazz. And in the past, about 8 years ago, I started a Tom Waits tribute band called Small Change.
Yeah.
This is just with the jazz group I was playing with. We got offered a gig at Nectar's, and I thought, my jazz quartet at Nectar's? I don't think that's going to work. I'll tell you what, I know some Tom Waits songs just because I like them, and I was singing them in the car to keep myself awake on the way home from jazz gigs. And so
it'll definitely keep you awake if you're singing along to Tom Waits.
And so that...
If only with the ensuing coughing fits.
Right. I could tell you about how that worked out if there's time after. But and then the past year or so, I've been playing guitar with a group called Tiny Montgomery, which does just Bob Dylan songs. Yeah. And a month or so ago, we were playing in Burlington at Red Square.
Yeah.
And this is when this occurred to me. And we're playing One More Cup of Coffee or some just far out tune.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I can do whatever I want. If I'm on a jazz gig and I'm playing at Lunix and I get a little too weird, if I get a little too Mark Rebo on people or a little too Bob Gagnon, there's really not room for me to, on a jazz gig, to bring in my full range of influences. you know, the bluegrass, the country, the Chet Atkins I grew up listening to,
yeah.
and the rockabilly that I learned from my dad, and the jazz I learned in college. And I was a deadhead for a couple of years, so there was some of that aspect
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
And I, on many gigs, I have to sort of deny part of who I am, part of what I would wish I could express.
Yeah,
it won't fit in. It doesn't sound like enough like Wes Montgomery or Pat Metheny that people won't yeah. say, they won't recognize it as jazz if I don't behave this certain
you'll
way.
You'll ruin their dinner.
Right, and it's the same with blues.
Yes.
You know, I show up at, I got a friend, Dennis Wilmot, and he's been, I don't think they're going on currently, but he hosted a lot of blues jams. There was one at 51 Main before they closed, and there was one at August 1st.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm the guy who would show up and, you know, not play pentatonic blues scales over things. And it would sound, and I think it was interesting for people, but I have a friend who was watching us once, and she said, you know, I played a couple of tunes, and she said she heard a guy sitting next to her lean over to somebody next to him and say, jazz guitar player. Like, I was breaking some rules that you're not allowed to break when you play
yeah.
the blues. But if you put too much of something in the jazz, you're breaking some rules that you're not supposed to break when you play jazz.
Yeah.
Because people, if it doesn't sound like that one Miles Davis record they bought, then...
Yeah.
But there we are playing some Bob Dylan song, and I'm pulling out some jazzy vocabulary.
Yeah.
And I'm pulling out some Chet Atkins vocabulary, and I'm pulling out some country, and I'm going, wait a minute, this rock music is great. It is allowing me my full range of expression.
Yeah.
In a way, you know, the venue, the people I'm playing with, they're all adventurous, and they're like,
yeah, that's true.
Sure, whatever you do, Bob, is do whatever you want.
Yeah.
But in that moment, I thought, I have been denying myself by not playing rock music all these years.
That's true. I mean, rock, as much as I can deride any particular genre, I mean, and what I said about prog rock applies to so many other forms of rock music, that there's like there's a pantheon of, say, prog rock acts, and there's a pantheon of dead style rock bands, mm. and there's a certain expectation. But if you can go outside the norm and pull it off and do it well, you get rewarded for it.
I'm allowed to do it, for one thing, and that's
yeah.
its own reward, is that if I hear something, I can play it without worrying that somebody's going to go, that's not in this genre,
yeah.
you know. You know, we're not going to hire that guy again because
yeah.
he goes outside the genre. So there's that. And then, really, if you think of, I don't know, you think of the rock guitar players who you dig.
Yeah.
And they're the ones who really brought something new to it, you know?
That's a good point.
Frank Zappa brought yeah. something new to it.
Yeah. I'm thinking about some of my favorites just off the top of my head, like Steve Howe brought in that, like Chet Atkins, to rock music,
mm-hmm.
you know, in a truly original way. And, you know, Eddie Van Halen, you could say it's kind of cliche to hold him up there, but it's true. He still is one of my favorites because of how inventive he was.
It's true. He really, I was talking to my son about this the other day. I mean, remember, and actually I was saying how much I appreciate 1970s guitar solos
yes.
because they were melodic. People didn't shred, you
no.
know, the way you can put on an Avenged Sevenfold record now, and that guitar player can do incredible things incredibly fast. Although he's not the
yeah.
only one. It's like
yeah,
the LA heavy metal band guitar player is going to shred and do the tapping things that
yeah.
that Eddie Van Halen broke the, you know, he opened the floodgates for
right.
that. He changed the game. And he's the guy with, you know, credit for that.
Yeah.
Whether I like it is a different story, because I was thinking of 70s lead guitar.
Yeah.
Like Jackson Browne.
Oh.
A
very melodic player.
Yeah. Nothing was fast.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, that's true.
Even,
yeah.
you know,
there were a few people messing around with it in kind of like the fusion, what fusion was trying to do, which was mix the jazz and the rock a bit.
Sure, so Al DiMeola could play fast, and John McLaughlin could play.
Yes,
I love him.
Yeah,
I love both those cats.
Yeah,
Brian May, he did not play fast, but golly, was it melodic and beautiful.
And he embraced not just the style, but also the technology. He was one of the first, like Tom Scholz of Boston or Eddie Van Halen, who said that the electric guitar as a piece of machinery can be tweaked, and the amp. And, you know, because Brian May was all about that sustain and the harmonizing and that kind of thing. But anyway, we could talk about 70s guitarists all day. I want to bring the conversation over to the present. And you're playing with Tiny Montgomery, Bob Dylan, and you're still playing with Small Change, doing the Tom Waits show. And somehow about a year or so ago, I roped you into employing your progressive rock influences. What on earth made you think that was a good idea? Because, I mean, if you're talking about getting work, I mean, really the last thing you want to do is join a progressive rock band in Vermont.
Yeah. Well, let's think about this.
I've stumped you. I've stumped you. Now we know.
Yeah. Well, I get work, you know, with the other groups. And so, and
feel so bad now.
I've got this dear friend, his name is John Bowman, and he's in Eugene now, and I played in a group with him called Satori Bob, and he's still using the playing in, he still calls his group Satori Bob. He's in Eugene. Fantastic songwriter. But there was a guy in his band who said, when I take a gig or play in a band, there are two of three things I need to have, you know, two of three conditions I need to have met. And the three conditions are, I like the pay, I like the people, I like the music. Mm. If any two of these are there, I'll do it. And
I think I know which two.
So he's right. And so he said to my friend John, you see, with you, I like the music and I like the people. And you know what happened when I was, you know, I heard there was a need for a bass player in your group, and I've known your guitar player John since I was 12 years old. We met in seventh grade.
Yeah,
the way Getty and Alex met.
Right.
Right. And he was one who I didn't play with in high school. We were in the same classes in junior high, and then in high school I was mostly about the girl I was, whichever girl I was chasing or whatever, and playing guitar by myself. I wasn't playing with other people. And John was developing his skills as an ear player. I was developing my skills, and we just didn't cross, you know, with the magic of Facebook, we ended up meeting again. And then, and he had given me a CD or two of your band, Elephants of Scotland, and I thought the music was fantastic. And then I thought it just, when I heard there was a space for a bass player, I said, you need a bass player? And it is satisfies something that no other genre satisfies for me. And it's an intellectual pursuit, especially at this stage when I'm learning the band's back catalog.
Right, you're learning what other people have arranged.
Yeah.
And taking it into your own space. You're very much making, you know, half of the notes are your own, at least.
And I appreciate the opportunity to do that in your group too. And because I know there were some things, you know, makes an adjustment, especially for the rhythm section. If I'm not doing the thing that the drummer is used to hearing, then that, you know, that can make a difference of, you know, how the tune is performed. But not being there as part of the songwriting process, then I'm hearing things, and then I will have to go back and go, good gosh, is that really what I thought it was? Or, I mean, it's a wonderful intellectual exercise.
Yeah, how would you have written it also?
And, I mean, there is a tune that you wrote the music for, and Full Power is the tune, right? where the chorus, the first time and the second time, the chorus is played in the tune. It's in 7-4. Mm-hmm. And the third time, it's in 4-4. And, you know, so I'm trying to learn this tune from the CD, and I'm going, oh, that part's in 7-4. Okay, good. And then the third time comes along, it isn't. And I'm like, what? Yep. And I can't really move the needle back.
Right.
But
sorry about that.
But it's interesting. I've been with you, with your group, for part of the songwriting process for, yeah, you know, for a new tune. And now I can see that, oh, we need to do this. We need to have this many beats in this measure to support the lyrics.
Yes.
Which were not written as a song lyric. It was a poem.
Yeah.
So to make this fit, we've got to do this here.
And so the new song, right, that you're talking about, Seven Birds of Carrion, is exactly like Full Power in that they were written as poems.
Mm.
And then I set them to music, and then I realized that the flow of the words was kind of funky if it worked in seven those first few times. But enough about me.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask you a few things about what you love about Vermont and your home state. Tell me first about your favorite Vermonter.
Yeah. And I have to pick my grandfather. Now, this is a person, Joseph A. Gagnon. My father is Joseph B. and my brother is Joseph C.
And clever.
Yep. And then my brother's son is Walter. So I guess,
yeah.
I guess that stops there, but he was born in St. Albans, when his father was from Quebec and came down to St. Albans. And by the time I have a clear memory of him, because, you know, I knew him all my growing up years, but you're sort of in your own bubble sometimes.
Yeah.
We would go to their house on Porter's Point Road in Colchester.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I would be bored. Or we would, yeah, play music, and he would play his harmonica. And there were a lot of years where I didn't realize the range of things that this man knew. And then as I got older, then I could go, wait a minute, he upholstered all these chairs? Wait,
oh,
he just grafted all those apple trees in the backyard? There's his garden. You know, he built this. And he was not, you know, he didn't go around bragging about all the things that he knew. It's just in later years I began to notice just what this person was sort of contributing to the world.
It's tough to get to know your grandparents. It really is.
When you're a kid, you're in your own. I was in my own little world.
And you have no context for adulthood.
Right.
Yeah. Tell me about your favorite Vermont place.
Okay. And this is hard to. There's a lot of good ones.
Mm-hmm.
But I love Battery Park. And when I was a kid, of course, we lived in an apartment a half a block from Battery Park.
Yeah.
So I spent a good deal of time there in the stroller. And then we just continued to visit. I mean, we lived in Burlington until I was 5 or 6. And then it was just always a place to go. And Beansy's bus has been there forever.
It's still there.
I mean,
yeah,
it's still there. And I think it started 20 years before I was born.
Oh, that's funny.
I have two sons, 17 and 12, and the 12-year-old loves it there. So it's what we do in the summer is, you know, we leave the islands.
Yeah.
And we come into Burlington to spend the day at Battery Park.
Nice. And they got the concert series. Yeah.
Right. Which I haven't been there for a concert series, but and the waterfront is beautiful now. And when I was a kid, it was not.
That's true.
You know, we had a
much more industrial.
It was industrial waste. It was, you didn't go there.
Yeah.
I remember once going there as a kid. This must have been around 70, 71, 72, because I have a clear memory of going down with my parents, seeing hippies,
yeah,
on the roof, you know, like on their porch roof or something like that. They crawled out. And I remember hearing the Doors on the radio, which could be why I dislike the Doors to this day, but look, when you're 5 years old and there's a killer on the road and there's thunder and rain.
Oh, that's the last thing you want to hear.
I'm like, what? That was just creepy. And anyway, I like the band.
Yeah.
It was the singer who was creepy. And I remember going down there and seeing dirt and trash and, you know, riding railroad cars and something like that. And there was a rubber glove in the water. And I thought it was a human hand. And my dad then told me that it was a human hand.
Oh, that was nice.
So that was it. But anyway, that's my memory. And, you know, it was, like a petroleum, you know, like when you fly over Newark and you look down and you see those white tanks?
Yes.
There were 80 of them down at the Burlington Waterfront.
That's right, yeah.
And then they got this nice mayor in 1980.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
Yeah, and that was Bernie Sanders. And,
yeah.
And then they cleaned it up, and it's nice now.
Yeah.
But the view of the Adirondacks is stunning.
Yeah. So I guess you wouldn't call that pre-1980 your favorite Vermont memory then.
It was just what it was.
Yeah.
It's not a bad memory.
Yeah.
I mean, that day was bad with the floating hand, but...
I was just trying to do a not so subtle segue into the next question about your favorite Vermont memory.
You know what happened when we left Burlington? We moved to Jericho, and I'm 6 years old, and you know, little twin brothers were born when I was seven.
Yeah,
that's eight people in a house, and it was nuts. And a quarter mile from our house was the Browns River.
Yeah.
So we lived on a road called Packard Road, and walk across Route 15 and cross somebody's yard and into a farm field. And I would bring a fishing pole and a pocket full of hooks, and I would flip logs over or kick cow poops over and get some worms or crickets. And there's my bait, and I discovered trout fishing down there.
Nice.
And that any possible day that I could be at the river trout fishing, I was.
Yeah.
And then the best Vermont memory is bringing my little sister. We're kind of the two middle ones. They're two older than us and then two younger, and the two younger are twins, identical twins. So we kind of...
You had your own clique.
We were our own little middle child, my little sister and I. And this great time, I said, you gotta catch a trout. And I was trying to tell her where to cast her worm, and she wasn't getting it in the exact spot. So I said, give me your pole. And I said, I want you to cast right there. And I dropped the worm where I wanted it.
Yeah.
And a brookie came up from underneath and grabbed it. Water's crystal clear, so we could see all this. Yeah. And then I handed her the pole and said, there.
Okay.
There's your trout.
Nice. Okay, real quick, your favorite Vermont food and drink.
Okay. The favorite Vermont drink changes depending on you know, what's on tap.
Yeah.
But I'm really digging Fiddlehead currently. It was Switchback for a while, but now you can buy Switchback in the store, so the whole aspect of get you a little something that you can't get at home.
Yeah.
Lost
that appeal.
So that makes Fiddlehead a little more special.
And your favorite Vermont food.
And it comes from the French Canadian roots.
Yeah.
And it's tortilla. It's the meat pie that my mom makes for Christmas. It's what we would have for Christmas dinner, because who wants to cook for eight kids, right?
Mm-hmm.
When there are presents and all that kinds of stuff going on.
Yeah.
So she would make them ahead of time and you know, heat them up on Christmas Day.
Gotcha.
And I was a vegetarian for a couple of years until I went to my folks' house for Christmas.
My wife made a vegan tortilla for me for the last 2 years, and it is amazing. So we're recording this at the very end of November, so I need to get you that recipe.
Okay.
If you're interested.
Sure.
I'm not going to force it on you. But anyway, that's a perfect way to end our interview, right back where you started, talking about growing up in Vermont. So thank you, Bob, for chatting today.
Oh, thank you, Adam.
You can hear more episodes of Vermont Favorites or subscribe to the podcast at imadeitup.com. Information on upcoming guests is available at the Vermont Favorites Facebook page. And Vermont Favorites is a production of WBTV LP 99.3 FM Burlington. I'm Adam Rabin. Thank you for listening. Take care.